So in any case, I wanted to finish up supersymmetry today. So I've ended up dawdling a bit, I suppose. But I'll admit that I have a bit of a pro supersymmetry bias. But everybody has their own biases, and I'm not saying supersymmetry is out there and so on. But of the various proposals, I tend to be most attracted to that. But I also want to cover other things. It's good to have a broad overview of what's out there. So I want to finish up supersymmetry before too long today, and then move on to theories where you address electric symmetry breaking and the electric hierarchy problem through strong dynamics. Let's get back to symmetry. Recall that we have a stable LSP, and the possible candidates in the MSSM are the lightest neutralino, lightest sneutrino, or gravitino. The sneutrino doesn't work so well, at least the MSSM one, because it turns out that it has relatively large weak couplings. And the amount that you'd expect left over cosmologically would be enough that we would have seen it in various dark matter searches already. Whereas this state's harder to see. The gravitino is a bit more complicated. The story for gravitino with dark matter it's not a bit of a mess, but it really depends on the cosmological history of the universe. So the story with the neutralino, and one reason why it's very popular, is that you have this mechanism of thermal freeze-out. And the idea of thermal freeze-out is that if you go back in the early universe, it was very hot, and you have particles bouncing around in undergoing reactions. But for a lot of that evolution, you can think of the particles as being in thermodynamic equilibrium. But it's not a perfect equilibrium because there's a slow change in the background from the expansion of the universe. And what you end up doing to test whether a certain process is equilibrating or not is you look at the rate of that process, and you compare it to the Hubble expansion rate. And as far as these particles go, as the temperature of the universe cools down but below their mass, their density becomes Boltzmann suppressed. So the density ends up getting a suppression that goes like e to the minus m over t, just because it's very rare to have a thermal fluctuation that is energetic enough to produce one of these if your temperature is less than the mass. And on the other hand, the forward reaction, where a pair of neutralinos annihilates into some light standard model states, is unsuppressed by the kinematics. And what can happen, though, is that eventually, because your equilibrium density is falling off like this, you end up with a very low density of these neutralinos. And if you have a low enough density, the rate for them to annihilate under the forward reaction also falls out of equilibrium. And you did an estimate of this on one of the tutorials. And the upshot of this is that you can get an excess density of these guys larger than the equilibrium value. It would just be Boltzmann suppressed for any temperature. You end up with a larger than the equilibrium value. And this larger than equilibrium value is left over as what you see as dark matter today. So there's a nice story here. The thing with gravitinos, though, is that they interact much more weakly than neutralinos. And they don't tend to equilibrate as well. So the story with gravitino dark matter, it really depends on how hot the universe became after inflation. And it depends on how hot the universe became after inflation, and also the other stuff going on. So one possibility for gravitino dark matter is that if the decay of the neutralino is fairly slow, you have just regular neutralino freeze out in the usual dark matter way. But then the neutralino decays into gravitino at some later time. And in this case, the gravitino number density is set by the number density you would have had of the neutralino. So I'm just mentioning this in passing. If you dig around on my website, I have some notes on dark matter from actually an earlier PSI course that I taught. And you can read about them there, or this will probably be covered in the dark matter course if you take that. But I'm just mentioning this in passing. In any case, you have these states. And the nature of the LSP is going to have a big effect on what the signals look like at particle colliders. So I'll come back to this in a second, but just keep in mind that these stable LSPs will be important down the road. So that's one consequence of supersymmetry, the stable LSP. Another consequence of supersymmetry is related to supersymmetry breaking. So if you remember that our Lagrangian, our MSSM Lagrangian at the supersymmetric level basically has the same number of parameters as the standard model. Everything's related by supersymmetry. But when we put in soft supersymmetry breaking, as we have to, we have to introduce a whole bunch of new parameters. And this ends up being a bit of a mess. And it can also be a problem in the sense that some of the soft terms you can write down. So if you recall, I had written soft terms of this form. So this is a soft scalar mass. In this case, I'm writing the soft scalar mass for the for left-handed quark doublet. But what I didn't write when I wrote it earlier is the generation structure, the so-called flavor structure. And I put that in implicitly, but what ends up happening is that, well, in general, I'll have a term like this for, let's say, the first generation doublet, the second generation, and the third generation doublet. But on top of that, I could also have off-diagonal flavor pieces, in the sense that I could have a form like this, where I would have off-diagonal pieces, for example, of the form, I don't know, for example, like M23 and Q tilde 2 dagger, Q tilde 3, where this Q tilde 2 corresponds to the doublet with the charm and the strange. And this thing would correspond to the doublet with the stop and the spottom. And this and the fact that I can write down these terms means that soft supersymmetry breaking gives me a new source of flavor mixing. So in the standard model, your only source of flavor mixing is the CKM matrix. And we've gone off and we've measured flavor mixing in a lot of very high precision experiments. And what we find, all the observations we find, seems to be very consistent with the CKM picture of flavor mixing and also the CKM picture of CP violation. With soft supersymmetry breaking, in general, we have these new off-diagonal mass terms. And these off-diagonal mass terms are a huge problem. And in fact, if I didn't know anything about the underlying theory of supersymmetry breaking, and I just wrote down generic soft mass terms, and I applied the constraints based on current measurements of flavor mixing, if I had so-called anarchic soft terms, and in this case, anarchic means that the off-diagonal elements are about the same size as the diagonal ones. Like there's no underlying structure. I get constraints on the order of M soft greater than something like 100 TeV, which is like 10 to the 5 GeV. And this is a huge problem if we want supersymmetry to stabilize the electric hierarchy. Because remember, the size of the Higgs mass correction, delta mu squared, goes like coupling squared over 4 pi squared times m soft squared. So if our soft mass scale is being pushed to like 10 to the 5 GeV, and we want this to be 100 GeV squared, we have a serious naturalness problem. So a bit better than before, but still a problem. So one of the puzzles with supersymmetry, and specifically supersymmetry breaking, are the new sources of flavor mixing. And in the same way, you can also have new sources of CP violation, which are also very constrained. So this actually tells us something about the underlying mechanism of supersymmetry breaking. This tells us that the underlying mechanism of supersymmetry breaking, if we wanted to give small mass terms, should also give us mass terms that are essentially fairly universal and fairly flavor diagonal in this generation space. And it turns out that these so-called roughly diagonal or line soft terms are automatic engage in anomaly mediation but not gravity mediation. So as far as anomaly or gauge mediation, this is probably easiest to think about in the context of gauge mediation because everything's going through gauge interactions. And gauge interactions are automatically flavor diagonal. We can always choose a basis such that they're flavor diagonal. you end up getting soft terms through the mediation that end up being flavor diagonal as well. For anomaly mediation, it ends up being a similar story, slightly more complicated, but a very similar story. And these are one of the very nice features of gauge and anomaly mediation. But for gravity mediation, if you recall, gravity mediation, we don't really know what's going on. It's just some, we assume that we have some quantum gravity type associated states with masses near M Planck. And in general, without knowing what's going on, there's no particular reason for these off-diagonal terms to be especially small. Now, having said that, people have done a fair bit of work combining gravity mediation with specific theories of flavor. And what I mean by a theory of flavor is a theory that explains why the CKM matrix, corresponding to the Yukawa couplings in the standard model, have this seemingly structured form as well. In any case, the fact that we don't see flavor mixing tells us something about the mechanism of supersymmetry breaking. And okay, so this is one of the, this is both one of the, well, if you like this, this is one of the downsides of extending the standard model of supersymmetry. You get new flavor mixing. The next thing I'd like to get to is to come back to this this hierarchy problem and how it relates to the Higgs mass in the MSSM. So it turns out that specifically within the MSSM, the quartic terms for the Higgs potential are set by the electroweak gauge couplings, G1 squared and G2 squared. And if you call it just in a generic Higgs model, the mass of the Higgs is something like the square root of the effective quartic coupling times the BEV. Now, it turns out that numerically, in the MSSM, this translates into a an upper bound on the tree level mass of the lighter CP even Higgs-like state. And this is usually the state we associate with the standard model-like Higgs that we've observed at the LHC. And the problem is that this is obviously less than or equal to mz squared. But the measured value of this is about 125 GV squared. So this looks like an obvious problem for the MSSM. The way out, it turns out, though, is that this is only a tree-level relation. And from loop corrections, you can have effective loop corrections that contribute to the effective quartic of this Higgs. And these corrections to the effective quartic, first of all, can push up the mass of this MH squared. And if I look at them, if I look at these corrections in a certain limit, they take the following form. So if I look at these corrections in a particular limit, they take the following form. So this is the one loop correction to the tree level Higgs mass. So this is tree level, and this is one loop. So the total Higgs mass is the sum of this, which can asymptote to roughly mz squared, plus this correction, if I include the one loop correction. And the higher order corrections tend to be not so big. So here, this is the regular standard model top mass. This is the standard model top Yukawa, which is about 1. This sine squared beta goes to 1 as beta goes to pi over 2. And this is a log. This is obviously a log of the left and right-handed effective stop masses relative to the top mass squared. So I told you earlier that the left and right-handed stops mix after electric symmetry breaking. This expression applies specifically in the limit where that mixing is turned off. If I turn on the mixing, there are extra corrections, but they're still roughly the same size. So we see that to push up the Higgs mass squared above what we need, we have to push up these stop masses. And this means that we have to push up roughly the geometric mean greater than about 1,000 GeV. So based on the observed Higgs mass, if we're identifying with this MSSM state, we see that we need relatively large scalar tops. On the other hand, as we push up the stop masses, we explicitly see fine-tuning. And one way to see how the fine-tuning comes in is if we look at the minimization condition, if we look at the minimization condition for the potential to give you electric symmetry breaking, for larger tan beta and in the so-called decoupling limit, what you get is it ends up asymptoting to something that looks like minus 2 mu squared minus 2 mh squared. So this applies in the limit of larger tan beta, a fair bit larger than 1, and mz over ma much, much less than 1. So this limit is also motivated by the fact that the observed Higgs seems to be very standard model-like. This so-called decoupling limit, where mz over ma is very small, and the larger tan beta is going to enhance this correction. But if I look at this minimization condition, first of all, recall that negative values of mh squared are what you want to destabilize the potential. And again, here you go back and you see that you want negative values of mh squared to give you a positive thing here, because this is manifestly positive. But the other thing is, to get mz squared, which is roughly 100 GeV squared, we need a cancellation between this term, and this is a mu term from the superpotential, and this is a supersymmetric term, whereas this is a supersymmetry breaking term. And at least from the low energy point of view, these two things would seem to be completely unrelated, and there's no particular reason why they should be close to each other. So we would expect that, based on naturalness, the mu term and mh up squared should be relatively small. Otherwise, we need to cancel these things off very, very, very closely with respect to each other to give us mz squared. Now, if I look at the corrections to this parameter, mh up squared from superpartners, and in particular from the stops, the correction to delta mh up squared ends up looking something like minus 12 y top squared over 4 pi squared and stop squared log so here this log is a log of the messenger scale relative to the stop mass, and this is the stop mass, so if you like, it's roughly this geometric mean, and this is the top power. So this expression is the detailed statement of fine-tuning in the MSSM, in that because I have superpartners, the quadratic divergences cancel, but I'm still left over with finite corrections. And the leftover finite corrections mean that you get large corrections to this mh up squared parameter, whereas this thing stays essentially uncorrected. And the size of these corrections to this if you like, Higgs mass parameter, are proportional to the square of the soft mass times some coupling with some possible log enhancement. So the structure of these corrections to this Higgs mass parameter end up taking essentially that form. And they're even a little bit worse because of the log enhancement. And what we see from this is that even with supersymmetry, we are hit by fine-tuning as we start making these soft mass parameters large compared to the weak scale. Because what happens is this becomes big, which means that this becomes big, which means that this has to become big to cancel it off. But then you're canceling big thing against big thing to get little thing. And roughly, this is a very rough measure, but very roughly, the amount of fine-tuning in the MSSM is something like mz squared over m stop squared. So the degree to which I have to tune this stuff, it turns out with the log and with this prefactor, you end up getting roughly coefficient close to 1. And that means that roughly the size of the correction to this is roughly m stop squared, and we want to cancel that off against mz squared. And by this fine-tuning measure, what I mean is that the smaller the number, the worse the fine-tuning. So if this was order 1, then I wouldn't have much fine-tuning. If this was, let's say, 100 GeV squared over 1,000 GeV squared, this would be 1/10 squared, so 10% tuning. But in any case, you see intuitively that as I push up the stop masses, there is a there's a tuning tension. And this implies that even the MSSM, because of the observation of 125 GeV Higgs, has a bit of tuning. That the fact that I have to push up the stops to get the Higgs mass, right? And here, what I gain is only logarithmic. And the cost of this logarithmic enhancement in the observed Higgs mass is a quadratic enhancement in this effective Higgs mass parameter that I have to cancel off to get mz squared, mz squared. So there is a small fine-tuning tension in the MSSM. Again, it's order, let's say, order 10%, or maybe even a little bit worse. But it is a bit unattractive because our whole motivation for supersymmetry in the first place was to get rid of this fine-tuning. It's still much better than, say, a fine-tuning of something like mz squared over m Planck squared, but it's still a bit concerning. Now, it turns out that I can extend the MSSM, and specifically I can extend the MSSM Higgs sector in ways that will push up the tree-level Higgs mass. And these extensions can help a little bit, but still not too much. So the sense in which searches for supersymmetry at the LHC are both constraining the tuning of the MSSM through measuring the Higgs mass, but also through the fact that there are direct searches for scalar tops for these stops at the LHC. And these stop searches are also approaching the TeV level. As we get more data at the LHC, we'll push up the limits on the stop masses. And as we push up the limits on the stop masses, this MSSM picture at least becomes less and less plausible because we need more and more tuning to make it work. So this is sometimes called a little hierarchy problem, and that there still is a hierarchy. Well, it's a little hierarchy problem in that the tuning is this and not mz squared over m Planck squared, but it's still a little bit of a tuning. And the last thing I'd like to mention before moving on to the next topic are collider searches for supersymmetry. Because collider searches are going to be, in the next few years, our best method of testing supersymmetry directly. And because the main collider we have will be running, actually starting this spring, is the LHC, I'm going to focus on LHC searches. So the LHC collides beams of protons in the center of mass frame with the center of mass frame with the center of mass energy of the previous run was either 7 or 8 TeV, and the new run is going to start off at about 13 TeV. So this is roughly the energy of the proton-proton collision. Now, the actual underlying collision has a significantly smaller energy, because when you collide protons at high energy, you can think of this proton-proton collision as actually a collision between the quarks and gluons that make up the protons. And these quarks and gluons only carry a fraction of the total proton momentum. So the actual so-called hard quark-quark or quark-antiquark or gluon-gluon collision ends up having a much smaller energy than the actual proton-proton. But at the same time, this is the best we can do. We can't just pick out the quarks themselves. So anyway, the LHC has these proton-proton collisions. And because these protons are made of strongly interacting things, the things you produce most often are the super partners that carry SU3 color. So I have a little plot. I won't bother drawing it, but I have a plot in my notes that shows the relative production cross-sections as a function of their mass. And the general thing, as you might expect, is SU3 charged super partners produced most easily. The other thing is that when you produce, let's say a pair of quarks or a pair of gluinos or what have you, these states, first of all, because of R parity, have to be produced in pairs. And the other thing is that we typically assume that the lightest superpartner doesn't have any color charge. And that means that when we produce a heavier superpartner, it's not going to be stable. It's going to be able to decay down into a lighter superpartner in a standard model state. So the general picture of LHC collisions is I have two beams of protons. And from these protons, I get, okay, they're different processes, but I'll just draw one. I could get a pair of gluons coming from the protons. Here's another gluon. And these gluons collide. And let's say I make a pair of gluinos. Each gluino carries color charge. And it can decay down into lighter stuff. And there are various ways it can decay. So here's one example of a decay mode. I could have a gluino going into a quark. Let me just move this up. And a squark. And the squark can decay into a quark. And let's say chi01, which let's say that's the LSP. And on this side, I could have, in principle, some other decay chain. So I could have another quark prime and squark prime. And in principle, I could have a slightly fancier thing where I have an intermediate state of, let's say, some chargino. And I could have something like a W and chi01. But what happens is, OK, first of all, you produce superpartners in pairs. And each superpartner decays down. And the decays are always of the form superpartner goes to lighter superpartner plus some set of standard model particles. And these decays continue until you hit the LSP. And then the LSP, because we assume that it doesn't have any color charge or electric charge, it turns out that it doesn't leave a signal of its own in the detector. So what you see from each supersymmetric event is you have a collision of protons. The protons make a pair of, let's say, gluinos or some other superpartner. Each of those superpartners decays down in this so-called cascade process. So you shoot off these high-energy standard model particles, in this case some quarks and a W here. And then these are the things you see. And then these LSPs come out as well. And the LSPs you don't see in the detector. And the LSPs, even though you don't see them directly in the detector, you can deduce their presence indirectly by looking at something called missing energy. Because these LSPs are going to carry off some of the energy momentum in the event. And if you apply momentum conservation, you might see imbalances. So the missing momentum in an event, and specifically the the missing transverse momentum, is that you take all the transverse momenta of the particles you can see, you sum them up as a vector sum, and anything that's not zero, you attribute to missing momentum, which you would expect from the fact that you have these LSPs that are stable and neutral and leave your detector without leaving a trace. So here I'm saying transverse. And the reason why I'm saying transverse is that in principle, you have momentum conservation in all directions. But the transverse direction for the LHC is a direction that's orthogonal to the beam direction. So you have some beam axis where the two protons come in. And the transverse plane is the orthogonal plane to that. And here, we're only applying momentum conservation in this transverse plane, so-called PTs, because even though we're colliding the protons in the center of mass frame, the thing that's actually colliding is constituents of it, like gluons or quarks. And in general, the gluons and the quarks carry different fractions of the total proton momentum. And we don't know what those are. So we don't actually know what the net longitudinal frame of the collision is for any given proton-proton collision. On the other hand, if we were colliding electrons, we would know the longitudinal frame, and we could apply momentum conservation in all directions. But here, we only know the transverse plane. And the upshot of this is that we can apply momentum conservation only in the transverse plane, but this can still tell us about the LSPs. So a very typical signal of supersymmetry at the LHC, because we expect to produce these SU3 charged superpartners most readily, is that when they decay, because of color conservation, you have to give off some quarks or gluons. And these quarks and gluons give you what are called jets in colliders. So it turns out if you shoot off a high-energy quark, this high-energy quark will go through a process where it radiates a bunch of QCD radiation. All this QCD radiation will reassemble itself into a color-neutral object. And what you see is, for any given quark or gluon, a spray of hadrons. So a spray of baryons and mesons that are color-neutral. And because these things all come from a single high-energy initial quark or gluon, they're all collimated. And what you see is essentially a collimated spray of mostly hadrons. And these collimated sprays of mostly hadrons are called jets. So the characteristic signal of supersymmetry of the LHC, the one that has been looked for most vigorously, is so-called jets plus missing energy. And missing energy is you take the missing momentum, and you just take its magnitude. So a lot of LHC searches for supersymmetry look for jets plus missing energy. Now, you can also get missing energy in the standard model from things. You can also get jets plus missing energy in the standard model from things like neutrinos, or even from the fact that sometimes you don't measure all the stuff that's produced in a collision. But the general expectation is that suppose I make a plot of a distribution of missing energy in a set of events, and this is the fraction of events per unit missing energy. What you expect is the standard model processes should have some falling off structure, because most standard model collisions won't give you any missing energy. Whereas supersymmetry is going to have some distribution that is further out of the missing energy plane. So a typical search for supersymmetry involves, I look at events in my detector, and I say, let's focus on all events where I see, I don't know, let's say, two hard jets with transverse momentum larger than a few hundred GeV, plus an amount of missing energy larger than, let's say, a few hundred GeV. And ultimately, because I expect supersymmetry to populate this region of the distribution more than the standard model, this can get rid of the standard model background to a large extent while still keeping the SUSY signal. So this is schematically the way you look for supersymmetry of the LHC. The actual detailed searches are more complicated, but this is the basic idea. Now, unfortunately, we haven't seen anything. And because we haven't seen anything, we can put direct limits on masses of gluinos on the order of about 1.5 TeV. We can put limits on the masses of the first and second generation quarks on the order of 1.5 to 2 TeV. On the other hand, for scalar tops, the stops, and these are the things that really matter for correcting MH up squared, the limits on those vary from a few hundred GeV all the way up to about 700 GeV. So as far as testing naturalness, the thing you really care about are the stops. The first and second generations don't actually matter so much because they have very small eukal couplings. So there would be a corresponding correction to delta MH up squared from, let's say, the up squark. But the up squark would come in with a coupling given by the up squark eukala, which is absolutely tiny. So one story that comes up a lot based on naturalness and based on the fact that we have these pretty strong limits on the first and second generations is so-called natural. Natural SUSY spectra. And the structure of these is, if this is the mass, let's say this is 100 GeV, and this is, 2 TeV, you end up having things like the first and generation quarks up here. You have things like the mu term down near 100 GeV, because again, the mu term should be relatively small to match it. And you'll have stops around, let's say, like 500 GeV. And then other stuff in between, like your, and you might have your gluino here. But this picture has heavier first and second generation stuff because I can decouple them, but lighter first generation stuff. So this is kind of the supersymmetry spectrum that seems to still be consistent with the LHC, but we're going to start with the new data pushing up these guys, and we'll start cutting into this naturalist space. So,
yeah. What about the bottom? Let's get a partner of the bottom.
The bottom can kick in too, but the bottom Yukawa is still relatively small. unless you make 10 beta really, really big. So the bottom states turned out to be limited at about the same level as the tops, at least based on direct searches. Okay, now one last comment about supersymmetry is, okay, yes, we certainly want to find new particles at the LHC. This would be incredibly exciting. But one thing that I feel makes this story even more exciting, more interesting, is that suppose we find supersymmetry. So suppose we find superpartners. This is already a huge achievement. But on top of that, if you find the superpartners, you can start to measure their mass spectrum. And as you measure their mass spectrum, this mass spectrum is largely dictated by supersymmetry breaking. And what you could do is, in principle, if I can measure this mass spectrum of the superpartners very well, I can use this to get clues about what the underlying mechanism of supersymmetry breaking is. And the underlying mechanism of the supersymmetry breaking can tell me about new physics that's at really, really high energy scales. So possibly it might also give me some clues about the underlying structure of quantum gravity. So the story of supersymmetry is beyond just finding superpartners, which is obviously something that we'd very much like to do. Measuring superpartner masses is even more exciting in that it would tell you about new physics that we couldn't directly access with our collider experiments or something. Okay, so I think I'm going to wrap it up here on supersymmetry and move on to the next topic. So let me just change my notes. And the next topic is a completely different approach for dealing with the hierarchy problem. And this completely different approach goes under the general heading of strong coupling and compositeness. Okay, so again, a big motivator for this is the electroweak tuning of the weak scale. And again, because the standard model has this fundamental scalar Higgs, is very sensitive to new physics at high energies and the corresponding quantum corrections. And another approach to dealing with this is, let's just get rid of the fundamental scalar. So this mass tuning problem isn't an issue for fermions. Remember that fermion masses have this built-in, if you like, chiral production. It's also not an issue for vector bosons, because vector bosons, as far as we know, basically always fit in as gauge bosons. And in the case of the gauge bosons, the gauge invariance forbids the gauge boson mass term as long as you don't spontaneously break it. So if we got rid of this fundamental scalar, and I should mention in passing that as far as we know, the Higgs is the only fundamental scalar we've ever seen, we wouldn't have the hierarchy problem. So the idea of strong coupling is to replace the fundamental Higgs with some strong coupling dynamics that breaks electroweak symmetry breaking. And you can do a replacement in two ways. So the first replacement I'm going to talk about involves a situation where the new strong dynamics itself does the electroweak symmetry breaking without an actual Higgs state in there. Now, it turns out that because we found a Higgs, or we found a particle that seems to have all the right properties to be a Higgs and all the couplings to be a Higgs, we don't necessarily want to break electroweak symmetry breaking just with strong interactions. But what you could do instead is, instead of having the Higgs as a fundamental scalar, the Higgs, through these strong interactions, could instead be a bound state of, let's say, some fermions or vector bosons. So in this case, your Higgs isn't a fundamental scalar. It's actually a composite bound state made of these more fundamental objects. And in this case, as long as the scale at which the binding occurs is not too much larger than the weak scale, you also get a solution to the hierarchy problem. So I'm going to start off with a strong coupling story, first of all because it's nice, but also because it sets up the compositeness story. And it's going to turn out that both the strong coupling story and the composite story are going to have a related description in terms of extra dimensions. So after covering this stuff, I'm going to get into the extra dimensions, and I'm going to come back within the context of extra dimensions and argue that there are certain reasons to expect that the story with extra dimensions is in some ways, in some limits, equivalent to the story with strong coupling and compositeness. And this will be, you may have heard about ADS-CFT or holography. This will be sort of a, let's say, a hands-on and not rigorously proven, but still very plausible application of holography. But let me get off to strong coupling. And before talking about strong coupling applied to electric symmetry breaking, let me start off with the case of strong coupling in field theories that we know and we studied very well experimentally, which is QCD. So a lot of these theories of strong coupling compositeness are modeled after QCD. So let me talk about what happens in QCD first. So QCD, the fundamental fields of QCD are the Galeno field. So this is the Galeno field strength. And then I have a set of quarks. So if I focus exclusively on the QCD part of the standard model Lagrangian, this is what I get. I have my gluon field strengths. So these are my gluon fields. These are my quark fields. And in principle, I know I have six quarks. And the masses going into these Lagrangian terms turn out to be roughly, and it's actually non-trivial getting the lighter ones. So roughly, the mass terms going into here look like this. So first of all these mass terms, except for the top quark, are much smaller than the scale are much smaller than the Lewis scale. And it turns out that with all these, with this matter content, with the fact that this is an SU3 gauge theory, and the fact that I have this number of so-called quark flavors, it turns out that QCD is asymptotically free. So this is something you cover in the standard model course. And asymptotically free means that if I make a plot as a function of energy, if I make a plot of alpha s, the strong coupling, as a function of energy, which is, of course, is gs squared over 4 pi, this thing falls off and goes to zero at very high energies. So that's asymptotic freedom. So actually, I'm going to just give myself some room and cut it off here. Now, from what I understand, you derive the beta function for this. And the beta function, you can often write as just dd dt is equal to beta of t. And this turns out to be minus b over 4 pi squared g cubed at one loop order. And then there are higher order fractions. And the actual value of b you use depends on how many colors you have, which is 8 plus the number of flavors. And you can show that B is related to 11/3 times C2 of the adjoint minus okay, so this formula isn't so important in this context, but this C2A is the Casimir invariant for the adjoint. And for SUN, it turns out you just get N. And then these minus things correspond to the matter fields. So which one do I want? This sum corresponds to this is the trace invariant, the TATB invariant for all the representations in the theory that are two component fermions. And I have a coefficient 2/3. And this is for all the complex scalars, again, under representation R prime. So the upshot of this is that the positive part comes from the fact that my Casimir for the non-abelian gauge group is positive, and then this coefficient becomes more and more negative as I start adding more and more matter. And it all gives me B, but as long as this B is positive, if I define it this way, I get asymptotic freedom, and it turns out that this is the case in QCD. Now, suppose I start off with alpha S measured at some high energy scale, let's say on the order of M top, or possibly even below. If I want to do this this extrapolation, it turns out that when you do the extrapolation, you should only include the particles that are light compared to the scale in B. So in other words, if I do the extrapolation, just draw it here. If I do the extrapolation to the top mass, at scales below the top mass, I should not include the top contribution in the running. So it turns out that the matching with and without the top mass, at this scale, I integrate out the top mass and write an EFT without it. At this scale, my running gets a little bit steeper because I have a less negative contribution to B. And then I can do the same thing at M bottom and M charm. And it gets steeper. So I'm not drawing this very well, but you get the idea. And then it gets steeper here. But in any case, suppose I start just below M charm. And I have, in this case, below M charm, just these relatively light states. So I've gotten rid of everything else. I have some effective beta function that's valid over here. And I have some slope. I can take this equation, I can recast in terms of alpha, trivially, and I can solve for it. And it turns out the solution to this is 1 over alpha s of mu is equal to 1 over alpha s of mu naught plus b effective over 2 pi log mu over mu naught. And let's say I'm applying this with mu naught of a char mass, and this being the effective Yukawa coupling. I can rewrite this as alpha s of mu is equal to, OK, sorry, I won't rewrite it this way. I'll start off. So if I take this and I start making this log big enough, and I should say big and negative, by taking mu smaller than mu naught. So in other words, let's say I start here and I extrapolate down in energy. Eventually, this piece can become big enough that it will cancel off this, and my alpha s of mu will go to 0. Or my 1 over alpha s of mu will go to 0. And in terms of this story, that means that at some scale below, it turns out below the char mass, this alpha s actually ends up diverging. So as 1 over alpha s goes to 0, that means that alpha s is going to infinity. And we usually call this scale lambda QCD. So based on this, I can rewrite my general alpha s by matching to the scale mu naught where everything cancels as roughly 2 pi over b effective log mu of lambda QCD. So I haven't done anything deep here. I've just rewritten this expression using lambda QCD defined as a value of mu for which this thing is equal to this thing. So first of all, this is actually kind of a neat thing in the end. We started off with a completely dimensionless coupling. And the coupling, and in fact, the whole theory, if I ignore the quark masses, doesn't have any built-in mass scales at all. Now, if I keep on ignoring the quark masses, I still have my dimensionless coupling. But even though I have a dimensionless coupling, I find that a dimension full scale pops out automatically. And this dimension full scale popping out automatically corresponds to the fact that even if I didn't have any mass parameters, and even though all of my couplings and my Lagrangian are dimensionless, I'm forced to introduce a dimension to do renormalization. And that introduces a breaking of the scale invariance I would have otherwise. So in the limit where I don't have any quark masses, you can show that this whole theory at the classical level is invariant under rescaling lengths and energies by a common factor. But I have a breaking of that invariance by these quantum corrections. And this breaking of this would-be scale invariance by quantum corrections ends up generating this lambda QCD dimensional scale. And this is sometimes called dimensional transmutation. So we get two things out of this. The first is that, our theory of quarks and gluons, it works very nicely as you go to very high energies. But as you go to low energies, it gives us a dimensional scale, even though our initial theory, to the extent that we can ignore quark masses, doesn't have any built-in scales. But the other thing that's telling us is that this alpha s corresponds to the strength of the coupling. And very obviously, as the strength of my coupling becomes really large, perturbation theory is no good anymore. So even though I can compute perturbatively here with quarks and gluons, I don't actually know initially what happens down at low energies, because I'm losing all control over perturbation theory, and all my usual quantum field theory methods break down. So I don't have any useful approximations. So there are two ways to proceed. The first way to proceed has yielded a lot of interesting results. And that is that instead of calculating perturbatively, let's just take this whole Lagrangian with quark and gluon degrees of freedom and simulate it numerically. And these methods, you typically take this field theory that's defined on a continuous space, and you take your space, you discretize that space, and you make a lattice. And you do simulations where the fields now, instead of having values at all space point points, now have values at individual lattice points. And by discretizing the space-time, you get a system that you can reliably simulate numerically on a computer. And this has given us all kinds of interesting results. And one thing that seems to come out that is consistent with what we observe is that at low energies, instead of seeing free quarks and gluons, what you see are bound states with zero color charge. And the bound states we see at low energies are called hadrons. So hadron is just any color neutral object built out of quarks and gluons. And specifically, the hadrons we see consist of mostly mesons and baryons. So a meson, based on its quantum numbers, corresponds roughly to a QQ bar bound state. And a baryon, based on its quantum numbers, looks something like an epsilon ijk, qi, qj, qk, where epsilon ijk and ijk run over Coll indices. So this is an SU3 invariant object, and this is an SU3 invariant object. So here I'm contracting fundamental with anti-fundamental. Here I'm contracting three fundamentals with the epsilon tensor, which turns out to give you an invariant thing. And in principle, you could also have other hadronic states. You could have other hadronic states with more complicated color contractions. Now, this lambda QCD numerically turns out to be roughly 200 MeV, which is in the right ballpark in the sense that the meson masses end up being a bit less than this, and the baryon masses are about that size or maybe a bit bigger. So protons and neutrons, for example, are the best known baryons. They have masses of about 1 GeV. One more comment is that even though I'm writing these as quantum numbers, you shouldn't think of mesons and baryons as just bound states where it's just a quark with an antiquark or three quarks clumped together. You should think of these as the net quantum numbers. What I mean by that is that in principle, the baryon or meson can also have a lot of other things that carry no net quantum number, such as a bunch of gluons arranged in a color neutral way, or a bunch of quark antiquark pairs. So baryon, like a proton or neutron, isn't just three quarks. Its net quantum number matches up with three quarks in terms of electric charges, but you can also have other things bubbling up, like gluons and QQ bar pairs within the baryon structure. Okay, in any case, we have our low energy QCD, and one way to get at low energy QCD is lattice QCD. And lattice QCD is both very useful and very informative, but it's a bit harder to get intuition out of it. If you just do a simulation without trying to match it to something. So the second approach is based on effective field theories. And the idea here, and this approach is called chiral perturbation theory, and the approach here is to try to match up, is to try to write down an effective field theory with some set of new fields valid that describes the physics down in this low energy region. So it's an effective field theory valid at energies well below lambda QCD. And to write this effective theory, it's a bit more difficult than if we had a perturbative case. If we had a perturbative case, we just do the usual perturbative calculations and calculate some loops and match everything. And we would typically also have a one-to-one connection between the fields. What we have to do here, though, in this strongly coupled case, is we don't even necessarily know what field degrees of freedom to write down. But what we can do is try to write down a theory that matches up with the symmetries of the high energy theory involving things that are color neutral. So this sounds a bit cryptic, but in the couple minutes I have left, let me just give you a quick overview and then we'll get into it a bit more in the next class. So the approach, or the idea is low energy EFT. And we're going to use symmetries. So the first observation is that at energies below lambda QCD, which is order 200 MeV, the strange quark is not too heavy, but the up and down quark are really, really light. So as a first approximation, instead of having to worry about this relatively large scale compared to lambda QCD, let's look at a slightly simpler case, which is just QCD but with only up and down quarks. So we're going to start with two so-called two-flavor QCD. And then we'll go back and put in the strange quark later on. So if we focus on two-flavor QCD, I'll just put a little dashed line here. If we focus on two-flavor QCD, we see that we have these small masses, or these masses that are very small compared to lambda QCD, which means that as a first approximation, let's set these masses to zero and come back and put them in later as a perturbation. So now if I look at my QCD Lagrangian, where I set the masses to zero, the theory now has a set of symmetries. And that set of symmetries is Q bar I So that set of symmetries is easier to see if I rewrite my quark kinetic terms in terms of left-handed pieces and right-handed pieces. And if you recall, I started off with Dirac fermions. I'm still writing things in terms of Dirac fermions, but with left and right-handed projectors. But if you recall, the Dirac kinetic term split into independent left-handed and right-handed pieces. And I have an independent left-handed and right-handed piece. I have an independent left-handed and right-handed piece here and here. And I can rewrite this in terms of, in a suggestive way, where this QL means that I take these two left-handed guys and I make them into a doublet, and QR means I take the two right-handed guys and make them into a doublet. So again, so far I'm looking at pure QCD with two flavors, and I'm splitting things like so. And in this form, which is just a trivial rewriting of what I had above with no fermion masses, in this form, I see that I have a bunch of symmetries. And that bunch of symmetries turns out to be SU2L cross SU2R cross U1V cross, sorry about this, U1A. So SU2L means that QL goes to UQL, where U is an SU2 matrix. So I'll write this UL. SU2R is and these V and A symmetries mean that under U1V, QL goes to e to the I alpha QL, and QR goes to e to the I alpha QR. That's U1V. And then U1A, sorry about this, is QL goes to e to the I alpha QL, QR goes to e to the minus I alpha QR. And it's easy to check that these are all symmetries of this theory. And the whole reason I wrote these things in terms of doublets is to make explicit the SU2 symmetries. So I can do an SU2 on these guys alone, and it's invariant. I can do an SU2 on these guys alone, and it's invariant. And in principle, I could do a U1 on these guys alone, or U1 on these guys alone. But instead of treating those as independent U1s, I've combined them into a so-called vector piece and a so-called axial piece. And the vector piece transforms them both together in the same way. And the axial piece transforms them together, but oppositely. And I can combine this axial with this vector and get a thing that, and take linear combinations such that only this guy transforms or that guy transforms. So I've just recast my two U1s in a slightly different basis. Now, it turns out that this U1, it turns out to be broken by quantum corrections. So it's said to be anomalous. So for now, we're not going to worry about it. But I might say some stuff about it later. But what we're going to do is take the fact that we have a high-energy theory, the QCD theory, with a set of symmetries. And this set of symmetries is valid to the extent that we can ignore the quark masses. And we're going to go off and try to write down an effective theory for some low-energy degrees of freedom that also respect these symmetries. And for this, there's actually one more piece. There's one more piece, and I'll come back and cover this again. And that is that you can show that You can show that because of the strong coupling, or sorry, you can't show it, but it turns out to be, you can check it on the lattice, or it turns out to be the case. It turns out to be the case phenomenologically. That because of the strong coupling, there's a net expectation value for this bilinear operator. And this expectation value for the bilinear operator, you can think of it as the strong coupling become really strong and glomping together the QQ bar pairs. And it turns out that you get something that's on the order of lambda QCD cubed with a delta IJ structure. Or you can choose your field basis such that this is true. So this last fact means that suppose I look at this, and suppose I apply these transformations to it. It turns out that some fraction of the symmetry of the theory is spontaneously broken by this non-zero operator expectation value. In the sense that if I apply this transformation to this expectation value, this would change. So, well, first of all, you can show that the U1V leaves it invariant. So the U1V remains. But if I apply either an independent left or right transformation, this changes. But if I apply a left transformation and the right transformation and match them to each other, I get back this because they cancel out. So the upshot of this is that we have these symmetries of theory, but these symmetries are spontaneously broken. And because they're spontaneously broken, we're going to get a set of Goldstone bosons. And our approach will be to take these Goldstone bosons and write down an effective field theory for them that is consistent with the symmetries. So I'll come back, do this tomorrow. And then once we have the QCD story, we can extend this to theories where you break electric symmetry breaking through a similar thing. And for electric symmetry breaking, what we're going to have is instead of having a flavor symmetry, this SU2L, in this case, the SU2L is just mixing the two different generations. We're going to gauge this. And when we gauge it, this quark expectation value, or something like it, will break electroweak symmetry. Good question.
The two alphas in the vector and Dancilla are independent, right?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, sorry. But, yeah, anyway, I'll come back and cover this. But I wanted to give the big picture before I wrapped up. OK. Just one last thing. The new homework should be posted soon. OK.
We'll also post it in the size
episode. OK, very good. Yeah, and actually, it's probably safer to look at Tiber's version, because it's probably slightly polished compared to what I put on my website. But in any case, I have some notes up about this as well on my website. And I think that they'll be copied. They're still under construction. But if you want to read up on this with a bit more background, it's good there.